From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, our It's Just Politics team breaks down the push to recount presidential votes in Michigan and two other states.
This isn't about challenging the results of the election as so much as challenging how the ballots are counted.
John U. Bacon on Michigan's loss to Ohio State, missed opportunities, and the officiating.
One of these refs was fired in 02 for incompetence, brought back apparently. One was barred from doing Ohio State games due to the Ohio State bias in 06. That's your crew.
We meet Joshua Jackson preparing to take over for Diane Rehm.
It's kind of hard not to be a little awestruck and very humbled by this new opportunity. So it's amazing, and I'm incredibly grateful.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we'll hear about a very special place designed especially for people on the autism spectrum and their families. And guess what state is home to the most campgrounds in the nation? But first, this afternoon, the Michigan Board of State Canvassers certified the results of the November 8th election. It's widely expected that Green Party presidential candidate Jill Stein will ask for a recount, as she has in Wisconsin. She now has 48 hours to do so. Here to sort all of this out for us is our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. Rick, what'll happen if there's a recount?
It'll be very dramatic. In all 83 counties and county clerks' offices, there will be elections bureau staff. There will be attorneys for all kinds of interests there, all piled in as they break the seals on the ballot storage containers.
Seals that were put in after they were counted on election day.
Right. And then they'll start comparing, you know, ballots to, you know, voter numbers, seeing whether or not a vote for president was read, because that's one of the things that the Stein campaign is saying, that there's this discrepancy, Zoe, between how many people voted and how many votes were actually cast for president.
And the issue is that when you look at the ballots, there's a little more than 84,000 of these ballots where the voter didn't choose a candidate for president.
Compare that, appeared not to.
Right. Well, and compare that to 2012 when it was closer in the 43,000 range. So about half. So what you're looking at suddenly is a doubling of folks deciding to vote for other choices. Let's say maybe, you know, they're congressperson, but then saying, nope, not on president. Now, the issue here, though, is how remarkable is that? Well, it's a larger number than 2012. But let's remember, too, that both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have huge unfavorables. But what Jill Stein is basically saying is, hey, this is enough to raise some questions about whether or not, these machines read properly, you know, maybe a mark was missing. So this is one of sort of the red flags that they're talking about bringing it up.
Interestingly, this isn't about challenging the results of the election as so much as challenging how the ballots are counted.
The process.
And let's get that straight, because I think there's this idea that, you know, when folks are going, well, they're not going to be able to find 10,700 votes for Hillary Clinton.
And that changed the outcome of the election.
And that's not necessarily what the Jill Stein campaign is doing. Rick, you talked to the national campaign manager for Jill Stein.
Mm-hmm. And he said that what we want to do is test the system. Mm-hmm. We want to see how accurate it is, because we don't know whether or not the votes are being accurately tallied. And that actually brings us to one of the claims that Republicans might use to try and stop this recount from going forward at all. Which is that Jill Stein is not a properly aggrieved party. What they could do is go to court and try to argue that, yes, she did lose in Michigan, and yes, Michigan's recount law does allow for a loser to request a recount. However, she's not going to change the result in her favor. And so what they might do is actually go and challenge her standing to request a recount.
She got 1.1% of the vote in Michigan. So Republicans could say, yeah, you know, the law, again, as Rick says, you know, you have standing, but really, you know, you're not going to find 2 million
what you want.
Yes. Right.
So now,
what,
we know that last week with that New York Magazine article that broke the news that the Clinton campaign was talking to to some computer scientists and other election experts, including one at the University of Michigan, about the potential for hacking to be involved in the election result. So how does that play into all of this? And is there any reason to suspect hacking?
Well, the Clinton campaign, that's basically why they're engaging, that they say that we did not request this. We don't think it will change the result. We don't have any evidence that hacking affected the result. However, we'll be there. We'll be in the rooms watching the recounts to basically check against that and see if we find any patterns that might suggest that there was something like that in play.
Now, look, I am not a computer scientist. I'm not going to begin to try to explain all the details of what these very smart folks are saying is a possibility. Of course, they are not saying this necessarily happened. But I do want to key in on one interesting note, which is all along what we've been talking about elections here in Michigan being that they are on paper ballots and that you put them into machines that are not connected to the internet and therefore it's safe, that these couldn't be hacked. One of the arguments, though, that I think is interesting, and this, again, I'm not a computer scientist, I'm not going to read too much into this, but what these professors are saying is you can actually tamper with the machines well in advance, or that's a possibility, that at some point you have to put memory sticks in, and if you were able to get into the computers that had the memory stick and then you put the memory stick back into the main machine again. I put in here, not a computer scientist. But what they're establishing is it could have happened, right? That they think that it's enough and there's enough interesting dynamics in counties like in Wisconsin where only paper ballots were used that they did see an uptick.
And the Green Party, the Stein campaign, says that one other reason to be suspicious is that the software that these optical scanning voting machines use is proprietary, that it's secret. It belongs to the company. And they say that Michigan and other states should be using open source software so any computer geek can go in and look at it and say, yeah, this is the way that it's supposed to be, or no, there's, you know, here's a weakness in the system.
So what you've got then, Cindy, are these you know, claims, and again, they are claims about the possibility that it could have happened, but then also that the closest vote margin between presidential candidates in the history of Michigan. So I really think you're seeing these two things kind of swirling together to come to this point of Democrats and the Green parties thinking, you know, this is why we need a recount.
Now, we know the Clinton campaign certainly is backing the Wisconsin recount effort. Where are they in Michigan?
Well, they say they're watching it, they're going to engage in Michigan as well to keep an eye on it because they owe that to their voters and their supporters, and to just, you know, have another set of eyes on the process to try and find patterns if there are any to find.
And the Michigan GOP wants its eyes part of this as well.
You know what? Since last week on a lot of these listservs that I have seen emails from the Trump campaign and the Republican Party, the group MoveOn.org from the Stein campaign, all of them trying to recruit volunteers to go to the county buildings in every county in Michigan, all 83 of them, to keep an eye on this process.
What is this expected to cost in Michigan? If we go ahead and do this in Michigan, what kind of cost are we looking at?
$790,000 is sort of the estimated cost right now.
Which is on Jill Stein to raise.
Exactly. And this is where this kind of big raising of the money effort happened last week, where, you know, first it was going to be $2 million and then they reached $2.5 million, and it kept increasing. And it was so that the Jill Stein campaign could use that money. Although, as Rick and I have talked about, I mean, you know, on top of raising this money, the Green Party now has a huge database of information on, you know, all
people
of these.
People who donated, people who volunteered, and so does Move On, so do the Republicans and whatnot. But as far as the cost go, it's $125 per precinct. That's what the state charges. But they don't know over at the Bureau of Elections whether or not that's actually going to cover the cost in its entirety.
And when we talk about timelines, my goodness, there's all kinds of movable pieces and the possibility of lawyers objecting. So could we expect this to drag on for a while?
Well, the election is supposed to be, you know, all the vote counting, it's all supposed to be wrapped up and official by December 13th. But we don't know what happens if they blow past that deadline. And then the next deadline after that is December 19th, when the electors will gather at the state capitol for a meeting of the Michigan Electoral College to cast those 16 votes.
What message is this sending to voters and to citizens? Could there be any unintended consequences that you see that could come out of this recount effort?
Oh, I don't know. Look, I think if you are a Republican and you are happy with the results of election 2016, you're saying, you know, the votes aren't there. This is a waste of time, a waste of energy, a waste of money. You know, Donald Trump won. Let's move on. I think if you're a Democrat, you're absolutely saying this is worth it. This is the slimmest margin that we've seen.
And not all Democrats, though.
No, but if there is a possibility of malfeasance or as something like that, then we're all in. And my guess, Cindy, is that if this is reversed, we would be seeing, you know, the other side saying the exact same thing. And this is how politics work. You know, you believe in something until it doesn't work for your side. And then suddenly, you know, you want it changed. This is Donald Trump, who, you know, weeks before the election was saying, you know, this election is rigged.
No. And I'll let you know if I'm going to accept.
And it just serves to cast further doubt on the result in the end.
Our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta. As always, thanks so much.
Thanks,
Cindy. Always a pleasure.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and it is time for sports as we say hello to Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubank, and full of turkey and football.
football, and the turkey might not be unrelated.
There you go. Well, it depends now. Lions fans came out of the weekend happy, and certainly they're rowing the boat at Western with that great win over Toledo. But speaking of turkeys, we want to start with the Michigan and the Michigan State stories. Very tough weekends for both teams.
Yeah, for Michigan State, it was almost a mercy killing. It's a rotten season. They're happy to see it gone. They're 3-9. They had a great heroic performance the previous weekend against Ohio State, and they're out of gas.
But let's start with Michigan-Ohio State. And in the 113 matchups between these two rivals, where does that double overtime loss to the Buckeyes rank?
It will be debated. It was not the purest football game I've ever seen. Mistakes on both sides. But as far as pure tension, stakes, first game ever in overtime and double overtime at that, many will be ranking this one number one. If not number one, certainly top five all time.
No doubt that Jim Harbaugh, along with a whole bunch of folks I saw on Twitter, were really hanging the loss on the officiating. And I'm wondering, what is your take? How much of that was officiating versus how much was due to mistakes by the Wolverines?
And the answer is yes. Look, when you lose a game by 3 points in double overtime, I can point to 10 plays or calls that any one of them had gone differently, Michigan wins. Now, that includes, on the Michigan side of the ball, of course, the fumble on the 2-yard line instead of a touchdown, the pick six, that's when you throw an interception and the guy runs it back for a touchdown. Almost next best thing, a next interception that eventually scored. That's 21 points right there. In the fourth quarter, Michigan failed to gain more than 5 yards of offense. They had the ball for 3 minutes out of 15. All right, that's a problem. So all that is on Michigan. Flip side is the refs were systematically horrible. The worst we've seen in a big game, I can say that. One of these refs was fired in 02 for incompetence, brought back apparently. One was barred from doing Ohio State games due to the Ohio State bias in 06. That's your crew. Ohio State finishes the game with 2 penalties for 6 yards, making them the cleanest team in the history of football. Michigan, in contrast, had 7 penalties for 59 yards, which is about standard. And some of the overlooks and some of the calls were pretty egregious. If you're a Michigan fan, go ahead and point to that, and you're right. If you're not a Michigan fan, point to Michigan's mistakes, and you're also right.
You got it both ways. So the Big Ten Championship is off the table for Michigan. Any way it could make the college football playoff?
They've got a room full of powerful computers working on this one right now. Every Michigan fan website, and there are ways. They need a ton of help. Actually, if Michigan State had beaten Penn State, the path would not have been that difficult. That's how this whole crazy thing works.
Yes.
For Michigan to get there now, you need Washington and Clemson to lose their conference title games. You probably need Penn State to beat Wisconsin, and then Michigan might get in. But don't make plans and don't hold your breath.
And here, as you say, the Spartans, it was a mercy killing. Just be done, that miserable 45-12 loss.
Watch the offseason, though. Here's what's going to happen.
That's what 2017 starts today for Mark D'Antonio.
Absolutely, and that's kind of an advantage in a way. There are no more distractions. You got a banquet, and that's it. You're done. So what happens next is right now they've got 2 offensive coordinators and 2 defensive coordinators. That is a bad recipe. Too many cooks in the kitchen. So that, I bet, gets fixed in the offseason. I would be surprised if they don't have some sort of coaching changes going on. Now, some guys might take different jobs, so that might solve your problem for you. But that needs to be fixed, I think, for Michigan State to return to what it has been the previous 3 years, which is 36-5. That is a legendary record right there. You've also got a conflict, as we've discussed before, in the locker room between the fifth-year senior grinders who earned that record and their 2- and 3-star players coming in, and the 4- and 5-star players they've now recruited who don't feel like they owe the seniors very much. So there's been a conflict in the locker room throughout the season. That has to get fixed.
And that goes away with these seniors moving on.
Most of it. So look, don't count them out. D'Antonio did not forget how to coach in September, I promise you.
All right. Well, we have to go to Western Michigan, which beat Toledo Friday. And Toledo had a really good record.
They were, what, 9-2 going into it?
Something like that. Now here we have Western Michigan 12-0. And there's Heisman buzz about Corey Davis?
There's buzz. He won't win it.
Okay.
But he might get an invitation to New York for the finals. That in itself would be the first time any Broncos ever gotten that. So that's pretty cool. And they've got the MAC title game coming up.
Mm-hmm.
If they win that game, they're going to be in what we call a BCS Bowl, one of the top bowls out there. Most likely the Cotton Bowl, probably against Penn State. How about that one? So this has been a truly historic season four, Western Michigan, hats off.
Hats off. So that will be the MAC title game against Ohio Friday at Ford Field. And then the Lions were at Ford Field serving up another come-from-behind win. This was over the Vikings. So now we can say the Lions are indeed in first place.
You might want to repeat that.
The Lions are in first place.
There you go. Cubs win the World Series. Lions are in first place.
This is something. Their seventh fourth quarter come from behind win. And it's the fourth time this season they've picked off a pass in the last 2 minutes to hammer out a win. Is that dumb luck? Is that good playing? And can that carry them through the rest of the season? Because there's a few more games to go.
Yes, yes, and no. It is dumb luck. It is good playing that you cannot keep going to that well all season long and pull that rabbit out of a hat, to mix metaphors, throughout the season. Having said that, they're 7-4. You win 2 or 3 more games, you're probably in the playoffs. So out of the next 5, you got to win, 2 or 3 out of 5. Very doable. And we've not seen a playoff game in the state of Michigan in a long time.
91.
In a long time.
Who gets the biggest credit, in your view, for this happening for the Lions?
I got to go back to my man, Jim Bob Cooter, right there. He must have a banjo somewhere, I assume. It's a great name. He is in charge of the offense. He's in charge of Matt Stafford. Matt Stafford, in his 8th year, is finally playing like the first-round pick that he was 8 years ago.
Seems that Martha Ford's house cleaning a year ago has paid off.
So the best hire, I believe, the Fords have made in my lifetime is from Martha Ford, hats off. They got Bob Quinn to be the general manager. He is from the New England Patriots. They're the guys who win all the Super Bowls, by the way, with Tom Brady and all that. You got a winner in from a winning program. He is quietly cleaning house and getting smart guys in good positions. And you see all these little trades behind the scenes. This guy released, this guy's picked up. Man, it adds up. Detroit, dare I say it, they might be in for an actual winning streak.
Well, we will watch and see. A lot of games between now and January 1st, but it might be really a new year to celebrate for Lions
Could
fans.
Be.
Michigan Radio Sports commentator John Eubank, and as always, thanks, John.
Thank you.
Epiphanies.
Part of the community. The next idea.
Good ideas normally come from the collision between smaller hunches so that they form something bigger than themselves.
Inclusion, acceptance, support. That's the mission of Play Place for Autistic Children. It's a 25,000 square foot facility in Sterling Heights in Macomb County, and there's no place like it in the country. Play Place is a nonprofit. It gives kids who are on the autism spectrum a safe, fun, comfortable place to hang out, to play, to be with others. And for parents and caregivers, it's a place to find a Me Too conversation with someone who's also going through the challenges of autism. Founder Shell Jones is here with us now. Shell, welcome to The Next Idea.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm so happy to be a part of it.
Tell us how you hit upon this idea.
Well, I would guess I would say unfortunately, but you know what? My son is really, really a blessing, and that's how I look at it in a positive light. But he was diagnosed with autism at about 2.5. And so, we would go out and people would stare and they'd whisper, and they still do. And I just kind of wanted to find a place that, we could go out as a family and be accepted, and not be looked upon with, just insensitive behaviors because he had autism.
Yeah, so a place that's judgment-free and nobody throwing shade and giving sideways glances or rolling their eyes.
Exactly. Yes, and so Play Place is a place that it's a community that embraces families like mine. And unbeknownst to me at the time, Michigan is number four in the country affected by autism. We have over 50,000 individuals in the state that are diagnosed. And, of course, the number is, I'm sure, higher because there are cases that are undiagnosed.
You have built so many different elements into that 25,000 square feet of play place. Beginning with the design, what kinds of things needed to be built into the design to accommodate the needs of children who are on the spectrum?
What I did was I took it from a personal perspective, and I just kind of like put in things that we couldn't engage in with him having autism, like going to the movies. Because he has his iPad all the time, people aren't very accepting of that, of course not in the movies. And then he stims, which is, you know, from the outside, that's what you would see when we're in public and he's kind of making noises, strange noises is what you would call it, and he may have, let's say, flapping behavior or something of that sort. And so we threw in a carousel simply because we found ourselves at Lakeside Mall often because he wanted to spin. He wanted that motion, that sensory input. And upon being there, we would run into other families that were affected by autism that were there for the very same reason, you know, and they were traveling from very far distance just to come and have that time on the carousel. And so, you know, I wanted it to be disguised by play, but I wanted it to be much more than that. So we threw in things like a Lego castle, where as from the outside looking in, it looks as if, you know, it's just idle play. But, you know, they have to use their pinchers, which is fine motor skills, to put the pieces together. Then there's color matching. Then there's shapes. There's imagination. There's creativity. Every element about the center has some type of therapeutic value to it, if you will. So we have a laser chalk room where all the walls are chalkboard and they can write. Again, that's fine motor. It helps them to practice handwriting skills. They come in and they do games, tic-tac-toe, things like that. So it's a form of socialization as well. We have an art studio. We have a computer cafe. We have a store where I've kind of worked in where a program, what's called our Work Plus program, where we want 50% of the staff of Play Place for Autistic Children to be either autism-affected or special needs-affected children or young adults, if you will, that can come in and receive vocational training and education so that they can perhaps go out into the community and increase the numbers of unemployment, where it's 94% of our kids, they grow up and they're unemployed. And that's really sad.
You've built so much, and it's there for the youngsters, but you've got a lot for the parents and the caregivers and the family members.
Yes, this is a family center, so the entire family can come. And we use our siblings as like behavioral models, if you will, because they're actually indirectly affected as well. Because there are times when, you know, I have a younger daughter, and we were at Kalahari, and she wanted to stay, but it turned into a situation where we went swimming, we went back up to the room to eat. She got into the bed because she was a little bit cold from the water, and she started eating. And so my son looked at that, and he equated that to, they think we're staying. And so he immediately put his food up and he says, home, all done. And so my daughter's kind of trying to coax him into staying, but he wasn't really buying it. And so she said, you know what, Mom, I don't want him to cry, because he kind of started tearing up. She's like, I don't want him to cry, so let's leave. And so we did, you know, and I was very proud of her for that. But if she had her druthers, Cindy, she would have stayed.
Yeah.
But because of the autism, you know, there have been a lot of times where we couldn't go somewhere because it wasn't a welcoming environment for him. And so they're indirectly affected as well. And so you don't want it to turn into a thing where the neurotypical sibling is hampered by, you know, he gets all the attention and we never get to do anything, you know. So this is a place where the entire family can come and we can combat that 80% divorce rate, because we have a bistro where the families can come out and have a date night, if you will, you know, and go to the movies together, because they don't get that. The parents don't get that with this 24/7 challenge, you know. So
Yeah. And you have the resource nights. You're bringing professionals in to
exactly
offer support. I love the fact you have the haircut hut.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I totally forgot about that. And it's such a popular feature to what we're doing here, because we can't take these kids to the barbershop. You can't take your neurotypical child to the barbershop in a lot of instances. We have a wonderful stylist named Carolyn. She really understands these kids and she knows how to work with them. And we block off an hour, and sometimes it takes longer, but we're here for them and we're understanding and we care, you know.
So I'm hearing therapeutic efforts, play and healing and socialization, educational programming. And I know you're planning to open a retail store.
Yes, we actually have our store that's open now.
Wow. All of that under one roof. And this is the first facility of its kind in the country, and it seems like such a killer, great idea.
Yeah.
Why are there not more facilities like this, Shell?
That's the joke around our office. And so it's when we run into issues like the insurance as we were getting started, and it was like, okay, what is this going to look like in terms of insurance payments? And then we found that it wasn't as bad as we thought it was going to be. And even the insurance agent was surprised because we don't fit into any specific category because it is the first of its kind. So we don't fit into recreation and we don't fit into education because we're not a school. So it's like we're kind of running down the middle path and we're creating our own lane. It takes a minute to kind of break down those walls, but we're doing it. And so we imagine that that's probably, you know, no one has done this. You know, and we run into parents all the time that say, you know, this is what I wanted. This is a place that I've dreamed of before, you know.
And it is a big place. It's so well planned and implemented. So obviously a lot of money went into it, but you're a nonprofit. So give us an idea, because people are probably listening going, wow, how could we do this? What's the financial model for PlayPlace?
So it took like $1.7 million to build, and it's huge. That's a huge number, especially for a mom with no other experience, no business experience, actually. But you know what? It was such a community effort in that 90% of that $1.7 million was donated. Can you believe it? I mean, we connected with the unions, from the carpenters to the sheet metals to the pipe fitters. I never knew there were so many unions. And they all came together, and it was like a snowball effect where the carpenters called the sprinkler fitters, and then the sprinkler fitters called, let's say, Ferndale Electric, and they came on board along with the IBEW union, which is the electrical union, with an over $200,000 donation of lightings, because we switched over from fluorescent, which causes sometimes meltdowns in the kids and other issues because they can hear the buzzing and the flickering because of their high sensory levels. And they switched everything over to LED, no charge to us, you know. It was just a huge community effort, I mean, of parents and corporate leaders. And, I mean, it was just a blessing, truly.
If someone wanted to open a similar play place, what do's and don'ts would you have for them?
What I would suggest is that the programming is key. I think to just open a place like this without any particular input in terms of programming, I don't know if it would work or not. I mean, you have to kind of create things for these families to do and engage them and keep them coming back, because what happens is they want to come in where there are other parents that they can talk with and there are other kids that are similar to their child and that they can, you know, socialize with. And so if you've got different programming, like, for instance, we did the resource management, and we have one coming up on the 30th for Special Needs Trust. So if you engage these families with things that they need that maybe they didn't think of before, like nutrition, how do I get my child to eat properly, or he's such a picky eater because of the disorder, how can I sneak this nutrition in and he still be, you know, happy with what he's being offered to eat?
So you need to rely on experts and get input. Certainly a visit to see what you have done, I think, would be very, very helpful, too, so you could get a sense of that. What ages would you say PlayPlace is best suited for?
So we do all ages. Actually, I'm just finishing up a CBI, which is a community-based instruction program where today we have in preschoolers. Monday we had in adults. So the oldest patron that we've engaged or connected with was 52 years old. So it's for all ages. We have a teen night on Wednesdays. We have a Friday fun night on Fridays for 18 plus. So it attracts or caters to all ages on the spectrum.
It's a remarkable place. And really, we want to congratulate you on what you've been able to accomplish. And again, the first of its kind in the nation. And you can learn more about Play Place for Autistic Children by checking out the website autisticplayplace.org. That's autisticplayplace.org. Shell Jones, thank you for sharing your vision and your work with us and being with us on The Next Idea.
Thank you for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan outdoors and camping, they go hand in hand. We have something like 13,500 campsites in Michigan, the largest number of campsites of any state. But how much are we really communing with nature when we camp, when we roll into our state-run campsite, hook up to electricity, boot up the Wi-Fi, and set out our folding chairs under the awning? Landscape architect Martin Hoag has spent plenty of time exploring exactly what camping really means in 2016. His exhibit, 925,000 Campsites, The Commodification of an American Experience, runs now through the end of the year at Lawrence Technological University in Southfield. Martin Hoag, welcome.
Hi.
Good to have you with us. What do you exactly mean by the commodification of an American experience?
Well, I think it's really the exhibition looks at the history of the way that we've sort of transformed this ideal of being in nature over the past 125 years. And I think what I'm trying to argue is that we, although we have a great desire to be in the outdoors, we also have a desire not to leave behind too much of the comforts that we have in our modern homes. And so I think there's a kind of interesting dialogue there that, you know, campgrounds trying to engage between this, you know, desire for rustic experience and also trying to disguise ways in which these modern comforts can sort of infiltrate that experience as well.
What started you along the path of researching the American camping experience?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing because I, as a youngster, we never camped all that much. And it was only about 15 years ago, I was traveling in the American Southwest, and a friend of mine had lent me her tent and her sleeping bag, you know, thinking that I could take advantage of them. And I pulled into my first campground, and that experience was really stayed with me because I was given a map by the attendant indicating the location of my campsite in the campground. And I thought there was something so intensely prescriptive about that map and the kind of circling of the very specific spot where I was supposed to set up my gear. I think I had expected something a lot more informal, you know, just go out there, set up your tent in an open spot. And I think as an architect and my sort of training, that I think that particular moment always stayed with me. And there was something there about the kind of disconnect between what I had expected and what I was experiencing at that very moment with the map that I thought I should look into further. And that took me through, you know, about 7 years of work really trying to research that history of camping in the U.S. And it's culminated just a few weeks ago in the release of a book at MIT Press, which I'm really excited about.
And then this exhibit, and I know you're going to be doing a lecture. We'll have the details on that a little bit later. As you track the history, when was it Americans started camping, air quotes, as we think of it?
Yeah, what I talk about really is recreational camping. And the sort of historical baseline there is really after the Civil War in the Adirondacks of New York State. And I think at that point, camping is really the province of really wealthy individuals. These are men who would come from, you know, New York City, Boston, Hartford, and who were attracted by the rejuvenating properties of sort of life in the outdoors. You know, there was this great claims that if you spend a couple weeks out there, you would come back, you know, a healthier man. The individuals who would take up recreational camping at that point, one of the great ironies I've always been really interested in is that they really had to hire a number of local guides out there to basically help them take care of the sort of, you know, daily activities in the camp. They would hire people to hunt game, to fish, to prepare food, because really these men would have no way of surviving on their own in the outdoors if they weren't accompanied by this really kind of large team of helpers. And so I think even at the outset, when you think of recreational camping, you really think about this association with, you know, modern comforts, that it's okay to look for that rustic experience, but maybe at the same time, you're not completely willing to leave those modern comforts behind.
And able to. I would argue that most of us would be ill-equipped to just go haul a tent somewhere in some distant area of Michigan's Upper Peninsula and fend for themselves.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's what campgrounds do. They kind of find a way to disguise those comforts in such a way that there's the presumption that the experience is fairly rustic. And at the same time, you have access to water, electricity, and all kinds of services without which life in the outdoors would be basically impossible. I mean, it would be very, very hard to survive on your own without access to these comforts.
And unlike you, I did camp growing up. We camped as my family and I, because my dad was a fire captain in a family of five. That was an affordable way to get everybody around. We went all over Michigan. We went to New England. We camped all the way down I-75 to Florida. So there was mom, dad, and the three of us.
Yeah.
And I know we started in a pop-up tent, and then they added one of those tent trailers, pull-out tent, like an Apache, and then a truck camper where mom and dad got the truck camper and we kids were in the Apache. But I remember at that point, too, coming in, this is 1964, here's your campground, circle it. But isn't that also to protect the wilderness? Because goodness knows, since the car made it available for all of us to be able to get out and do what the rich people were doing after the war, we wouldn't want people all over the wilderness, would we?
No, and I think that's what really the idea of the campground as a facility really emerges in the 1920s. And I think it's the kind of model of the campground is as much to spare nature from human action as it is to protect, you know, campers from nature. And I think the kind of concentration of individuals in a very specific spot, which is the idea of the campground, really emerges in the 1920s. And it emerges as the automobile becomes more of a common fixture in American life. And I think you need cars to get to these campgrounds. Once you're on the campgrounds, the cars are still there. Oil is dripping on the ground. Cars are driving all over. So the campground is really a way to organize, create a kind of hierarchy between the campsites themselves, the cars, and the sort of negative environmental impacts that they might have on the landscape.
And I do remember, and I suspect it hasn't changed since I was a kid, that if you wanted to get really rustic, you could go to a national forest and get really rustic in the primitive campgrounds. They offered those. Again, protecting, but you were really on your own, whereas if you wanted to have your electricity and flush toilets, that was when you were in the main campground.
Yeah.
What is the message? What do you want people to take away from your exhibit, Martin?
I want to kind of shine a light on that infrastructure. I mean, again, the title of the exhibition is pretty direct. There are, you know, to my count, more than 900,000 individual campsites around the U.S. And I think to me, that makes camping a very popular experience. But it's also remarkable to me the extent to the kind of size, the expanse of that infrastructure. And the exhibition is really trying to understand the history of that from the sort of emergence of recreational camping, as I talked about earlier, in the Adirondacks, and really trying to understand how we got from there to where we are now. I think when we think about early recreational camping, this is the province of the very, 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 very wealthy people. And I think now you think about camping in a much more accessible way. And in that process, over the course of 100 plus years, you know, how do we emerge with, you know, hundreds of thousands of these campsites across the country? And to me, that's a fascinating tale.
Martin Hoag is a landscape architect who also teaches at the State University of New York's College of Environmental Science and Forestry. His exhibit runs in the Architecture Building at Lawrence Technological University, right there in Southfield, until the end of the year. And Martin will be lecturing on camping in America and its commodification. That's Thursday, December 1st at 5:30. Right there in the Architecture Auditorium at Lawrence Tech. And you can get the details on that on our website at michiganradio.org. Martin Hoag, thank you so much for being with us today and taking me back to my camping days.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
After a 37-year run, Diane Rehm is retiring. She'd served notice to her legions of loyal listeners that she would see out the election and then, at the end of the year, step away from the Diane Rehm Show. And much as Garrison Keillor handpicked his successor, Chris Thiel, for a Prairie Home Companion, Diane handpicked her successor, radio journalist Joshua Johnson. And he's here with us now. Joshua, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Good to have you with us, and congratulations. And I know that you know this, that you are picking up the torch from someone who is really beloved.
Absolutely. It's kind of hard not to be a little awestruck and very humbled by this new opportunity. So it's amazing, and I'm incredibly grateful.
What kind of talk did you have with Diane as this was all kind of coming together? What was her message to you, or her challenge?
You know, Diane and I didn't have that kind of a passing of the torch. We did talk, but I think a lot of the conversation I had with the leadership at WAMU in Washington really had to do with making sure that Diane and I were on the same page to begin with so that she didn't have to school me. I mean, I came up listening to the Diane Rehm show, and as I developed as a journalist, I developed a lot of the same traits and ethics and ideals that she and a lot of other people in public media have. You know, we have a desire to have civil conversation, a deep curiosity about the world, a very strong allergy to double talk, a love of public radio. A lot of those things just materialized very easily for us. And when Diane and I did speak, it was mostly her being very supportive. She said she was glad I was the choice. She gave me a big hug, and she just reiterated how glad she was to be able to hand the show off and move on to other things that she wanted to do. So it's been a good transition so far.
And we know Diane's last broadcast is December 23rd, and you will start the new year with your program, which will be 1A. What's behind that title?
There's two main things behind the title. 1A is shorthand for the First Amendment. And there are a number of freedoms enshrined in the First Amendment, five, as a matter of fact, that I believe are going to become very, very important in 2017. Some people are certainly exercising them right now. And I feel like this freedom that we have is something we have to exercise, especially in times of tumult and concern, which for a lot of Americans, this is a really tumultuous and uncertain time. So that's one meaning behind the name. The other is the front page of a newspaper. I used to work in public radio in Miami at WLRN in a partnership with the Miami Herald, and the Miami Herald calls its front page, page 1A. And those are the kinds of stories that we're going to be pursuing on the show. Those above-the-fold stories that are the really big stories that everyone needs to know about, that everyone needs to have a really good handle on so they can make smart decisions about their communities and their own lives. And then those below-the-fold stories that everyone's just talking about, that may be buzzworthy, that may be sparking conversation or controversy, that may be taboo, and that maybe could use a little light to go with all the heat, that just really bear unpacking and discussing. So it's kind of a dual meaning. It's this freedom that we have to discuss these important issues and to connect on them. And also, it's a promise of the kinds of stories that we will cover on the program, stories that are very worthy, that people are talking about, and that we believe we can help add to the conversation.
It, as you point out, Joshua, you are really launching this new program, 1A, at such a troubled and historic time. We're really at a watershed moment in our country's history. Right now it seems that no matter what is said, someone's upset by it. It's just we're so roiled up. How do you think a program and a space like 1A can help explore these sharp divisions and maybe kind of is settle the waters the right way to put it?
Well, you know, I don't mind unsettled waters. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. in his letter from a Birmingham jail talked about a kind of tension that is necessary for growth and for change. He said, "I am not afraid of the word tension." And neither am I. I don't think the fact that times are tense is the problem. I think the fact that people are not talking to one another, that's the problem. We're often talking at one another or around one another or certainly about one another. But it's so much harder to just talk directly to one another. It's uncomfortable. A lot of people just don't do it well because it's hard to do. It's inherently difficult to do. And I don't feel like people who are trying to be heard, who are trying to have this conversation, should feel bad that it's not going well. It is inherently difficult. But I think what we do need to do is lean into it anyway. One of the things that I believe 1A is going to focus on and can help with is allowing more people to be part of these difficult conversations. We want to create a safe space for people to be heard, for people to engage, for people to connect, even to vent or to debate or just to argue. It's okay for people to be feeling whatever it is they're feeling. I accept people as they are in this moment, and I don't expect people to just be calm and thoughtful and rational and give us a detailed 3-point answer to a very deep geopolitical discussion. We're not going to do that on the show. I mean, there's room for intellect, but if you're just upset, then be upset. If you feel like you need to vent, call, vent. Just say what you got to say. Don't try to scrub it up and pull out your 14-letter SAT words to try to impress me because we're on NPR. We just want people to talk. Just say what you're thinking and leave it to us to help govern the conversation, guide the topic, get us from point A to point B, and at the end, walk away from the conversation feeling like it was time well spent.
Joshua, do you have a few guests on your dream guest wish list for 1A?
You know, everyone asks me that. Of course, there's the obvious guests that we definitely want to get. I honestly am less concerned with getting the big guests than I am with structuring shows in a way that draws everyone in. I am much more concerned about getting those millions of Americans who don't believe that public radio is for them to listen. That's my real concern. And whoever it is we get on the air, that'd be great. I mean, there's a few people. My mom, actually, who is the one who actually got me interested in public radio in the first place when I was a teenager, she suggested that, and I think her suggestion is very much in the spirit of what we're trying to do. Her ideal dream guest for me is Michelle Obama's mother, Mrs. Robinson, because she wants to know what it's like to be a grandmother in the White House, to be behind the scenes and to give that understanding of what it takes to allow that first family to live out its fabulousness in front of America and the world. And I think that's such a great suggestion because, well, first of all, she's not a person who talks to the press very much. I'd love to talk to her. But secondly, it's one of those suggestions that is not an obvious get. It's one of those where you can't really presume what she's going to say. Like, you really have to listen to the hour to know what she's going to say. It's not like if I said, oh, I want to spend an hour with, you know, Michelle Obama. Don't get me wrong. I'd love to spend an hour with Michelle Obama. And if she says yes, I'm not going to turn her down. But you can kind of guess what she's going to say. You can kind of guess what we're going to talk about. But her mother, that's someone that is going to be harder to presume. So I'm really interested, and we are all very interested at the show team, in building shows that people have to listen to, where you know if you don't tune in, you are going to miss out. And there's no way that you're going to be able to get the essence of this conversation without coming to us for it. That's my main goal in building shows.
It does sound really great. And I love the fact that you do listen to Mom.
Yes.
Mom had a great idea. What's the date of your first show?
January 2nd.
Starting right off in the new year. And you can follow Joshua Johnson on Twitter at JEJohnson322. Have a great time ramping up for the debut on January 2nd of 1A right here on Michigan Radio.
We certainly will. And if people have ideas or suggestions or thoughts, please feel free to email us 1A@WAMU.org. We would love to hear from you.
Joshua, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Bob Scon. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.